It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
All right. So we got a slightly different episode for this one. This one came out to me at the time of recording about a week ago. I'm still not 100% sure we're going to put this in this series, but one of the publicists for a publisher reached out to us, asked if we want to have Mike Cosper on, both for his book, but just to maybe have some fun conversation on Driscoll and Wilson. So if you can introduce yourself, if people haven't heard of you or the podcast or the books that you've written or the wars that you are commentating on. So let's introduce Mike Cosper.
Yeah, so I'm Mike Cosper. I'm a journalist with Christianity Today. I've been there for, it'll be 5 years in February that I've been with CT. Prior to that, I did a lot of independent journalism work for about 5 years. And then prior to that, for 15 years, I was a pastor at a young, restless Reformed church called Sojourn in Louisville, Kentucky. And got to kind of see that whole movement up close and personal. People probably, the thing I'm best known for, if that's a thing, is the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast we did about Mars Hill and Mark Driscoll, who obviously has, a few Doug Wilson connections for sure.
Yep. Cool. So let's see. I'll start with Rise and Fall, and then I'll blend in some of the book. Sure. With this as well. If you can talk about the book, because that's actually my first connection with you was the book that we were asked to promote. So if you can talk about your book, and then yeah, I don't know if you planned it to be that stinking relevant right now, but it's pretty relevant for our times today, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, yeah. No, so I mean I sure didn't. So it's interesting. While I was making The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, there was this moment where there's this really important inflection point in the Mars Hill story, which is the moment when they changed their polity and basically disempowered all of the elders. They were an elder-ruled community. And in 2007, they made a change to the polity where they basically concentrated all governing authority in an executive team, which was basically like five or six guys that all reported directly to Driscoll. So Driscoll was in charge. It elevated his authority and his power in a really significant way. And what happened was one elder in particular stood up and said, hey, this isn't good. This isn't going to work. There's all kinds of problems with it. There's legal issues. The guy had a background as an attorney. And not only is this not good for the church, it violates our theology, our understanding of ecclesiology. And so we really need to do something. You know, we really need to talk about this a little bit. He didn't go public with it. He wasn't doing anything weird or disruptive with it. He was just saying, hey, I'm one of the elders. My job is to help deliberate on these things. I see some issues. And the result was a massive, almost violent response from Driscoll, where he called him out publicly and then privately went off on him, cussed him out, fired him. And it unfolded in this unbelievably spiritually abusive way, where kind of overnight, this guy went from being kind of the elder of the elders. He was the oldest. He was one of the oldest of the elders. So was his friend who kind of stood with him in the conflict. They went from being kind of the elder saints, the respected guys in the community, to being outcasts, being fired from the elder board. And ultimately with Paul, in particular, the guy that really took the initiative on it, Paul stood his ground. And as a result, they excommunicated him from the church. They cut him off from relationships, and they just destroyed his life. And it wasn't just Driscoll coming after him. It wasn't just the executive team. It was, 22 elders voted and sided with him.
Yeah.
And so as I was watching that whole process unfold, one of the things that you kept hearing in the language of the church at the time was the mission so important. We can't let this stand because the mission is so important. Like, we can't slow down, that we've got to do everything we can to be able to move the thing forward. And it clicked for me. In college, I had a background in political philosophy and political theory, and it reminded me of like, oh, this is like what happens under dictatorship. Dictators come in and they declare a state of emergency. Something is so urgent that the normal rules have to be suspended, and we have to concentrate power in the center in order to get us through the state of emergency. Sometimes that makes sense in war, but that does happen in war sometimes. But the difference between war and a dictatorship is that the state of emergency never ends, and that power stays concentrated for time immemorial. Anyway, all that to say, once that clicked for me, suddenly I started thinking about the parallels between what happens when ideology takes over a state and it becomes a dictatorship and it becomes an oppression, an oppressive place. It becomes a totalitarian entity, and what happens in these abusive churches when, theology gets distorted in such a way that it becomes ideological, and and it again, what sort of what clicked for me was like, oh, once the church takes on kind of the architecture of ideology, they can justify anything down the line, any kind of moral compromise, any kind of abuse, any kind of cover up. And it was like once I saw it, I couldn't unsee it. And it took me quite a few years to kind of think through it and go back and revisit, one political theorist in particular, a woman named Hannah Arendt. I can tell you more about her if you want. But once I did that, it was like, wow, it's so obvious that this is the best way I've seen yet to account for why do our churches full of good people who love Jesus and care about the gospel end up being on the side of incredibly destructive things.
Yeah, hers is what, The Origins of Totalitarianism? That's her famous work on this.
Yeah, so yeah, that was her first major work on it. It came out in 1950. And then I would say the book that's probably the most important, if you want to understand this phenomenon in particular, is a book she wrote in 19, I think it published in 1963. It was about the trial of Adolf Eichmann. It was called Eichmann
Oh,
in
yeah.
Jerusalem. And it was originally a series of articles that she wrote for the New Yorker. They were extremely controversial. It's where the phrase the banality of evil comes from, if you've, heard that used a lot. She coined the phrase, and it's sometimes misunderstood, but the general idea of it is that, she went to Jerusalem to watch the trial because she wanted to see what did one of these monsters actually look like in person. And then she encounters the guy and she goes, well, he's not a monster, he's a buffoon. And all he has is stock phrases and slogans and cliches and these dumb political talking points to justify why he did what he did. And so it that was the shift for her, because in the Origins book, she talked about radical evil, how the Nazi was this radical evil that had manifested on the earth for the first time. She expected to encounter radical evil, and what she found was banality. She found a boring mediocrity, who was a careerist, and he was the primary architect of the final solution. And so, yeah, that's where that phrase comes from, and where the concept comes from.
Gotcha. So you said you were, how long have you been working on this book? Because you said this has been in the oven for a little bit, as from what I
Yeah, I
can
mean,
tell.
pretty much since I finished The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. So I
Okay.
think the final episode of that came out at the end of 2021. So almost, it was almost 4 years ago that we finished, and I finished writing the book. I mean, ironically, I finished writing the book right around October 7th last year.
Okay.
So that it had, had other parallels and other things I had to suddenly
Sure.
think about I hadn't thought about. But yeah, so it was a good 2.5, 3 year project to get it written.
Yep. If you had not hosted Rise and Fall of Mars, so do you think the book you wrote would have been different, or do you think your hosting this changed your view of some of these things, or at least focused your research on this too?
No, 100%. I mean, I reckon with the Mars Hill story quite a bit in the book, because I wanted to try and, my assumption is that people who come across this book, m many of them, the vast majority of them, will be at least familiar with the podcast or have listened to it. And so, I use it as a reference point quite a bit, and try to say like, okay, how. Because the thing you kept hearing when you would talk to people about the podcast, people would just go, man, it just seems like this is happening everywhere. Like, why does it keep happening? Why do so many churches go down this rabbit trail of they start off with good intentions and good people, and then they wake up one day and it's this incredibly destructive thing.
Yep.
Like, why does this happen over and over again? And I was like, yeah, I was like, well, I don't know why it keeps happening over and over again, and I need to think about it more. And again, like I said, that main insight, I think, about really sort of what happened to Paul Petrie. I mean, that was the key for me being able to go, oh, I think I understand how this happens now. And it really shaped where the book went from there.
So if people are on social media, which can be a good and a bad thing, the book title, Church in Dark Times, they're thinking, and I don't want to get too pro or anti-Trump, but they're thinking like, hey, Mike, we're heading into the church's best times. Why are you saying the church in dark times? Because the church is at its highest power, or at least it's heading towards its highest power. We have people who have our interests in mind. Abortion has been overturned. How is it possible that we are heading into our dark times right now?
Well, so there's a couple answers to that question. One is, I mean, and this won't come to a surprise to anybody who's familiar with my other work journalistically, I am not among those who think that the advent of Trump has been a good thing for the church or for evangelicals.
Mm-hmm. Neither am I. I'll put my cards on the table.
Yeah. So, but then, you know, Arendt used this term dark times. She actually had a book called Men in Dark Times. And this book, the title is an intentional reference to that. And what she meant by dark times was this idea that we're living in this moment where the phrase she liked, and it came from Tocqueville, but the phrase she liked was this idea that the past no longer shines its light upon the future. We've lost a connection to a lot of traditions and a lot of institutions and ideas that really shaped our sense of identity and where we were in the world, where we stood in history. There's this sense of, you know, there's this sense of like atomization, isolation, mass loneliness, which was something she was very concerned about.
Yep.
That really kind of shapes the human experience right now. And it shapes it in such a way that it makes us vulnerable to dictators, cult leaders, charismatic personalities, you know, who show up and they find lonely people and they say, hey, I have a wonderful plan for your life. That's what means to be in dark times. It means to be in this place where, you know, it's like as a culture, as a whole, we're all Dante at the beginning of the Inferno in the middle of our lives, you know, unsure of which way to go. And I think that's a big part of, it's certainly a big part of her work. And that's what I mean by this. Like, the church is at a crossroads. And there's no doubt that, you know, regardless of what you think about Trump and Trumpism, you can't deny the fact that we're at a certain set of crossroads and that the church's influence in the world is waning. Now, there's all this sort of restoration effort by people like Wilson, people like Mark Driscoll, people, you know, the evangelicals that have really backed Trump, where they think, you know, we're in a moment of real serious revival. I happen to think what they're excited about is something more like death throes than revival. And we can talk about that if you want, but that's certainly what I mean by dark times.
Yep. Or it's they may not be looking for. And this is like, I'm just thinking off the top of my head. They may not be looking for the purity of the gospel. They may not be looking for the purity of preaching, for the fellowship of the saints. they're looking for a certain type of power that seems to be in grasp now that they felt like they had or they should have had in ages past. And now at least it looks in grasp right now that there are people in power. There are those in political high places who maybe not offering to them directly, but it looks like it could be on offer to them and they can grab these reins and say, right. Finally, the society has been against the church for so long. Maybe now we can drive society.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it certainly seems like that's the, it certainly seems like that's what a lot of people are grasping at right now is this notion of like some kind of return to Christendom. You know, you see it, I mean, you see it as well in It's, I mean, it's not just evangelicals that are kind of deluded in this way and tempted in this way. You've got a really strong movement among Catholics that's kind of looking at the world this way. And I think to a certain extent, the current that someone like a Wilson is riding on is a cultural current that's much bigger than him. But yeah, he's capitalized on it well.
So you talked about this, and this will kind of cross over with your work on Driscoll and some of the stuff that we're doing on Wilson too. And this is sort of like a question of did the chicken come first or the egg come first? Within the ideology that you talk about with the church, where it sort of takes over and then that drives the narrative and everything else is interpreted through that ideology. For lack of a better way of asking this question, is it do they see something coming from outside and then interpret everything from that, or is that has that ideology started from the very birth of the church or from the very birth of some of these movements, where it was there in their founding documents, they had it, but it may not have been as outright, as surface level, as public than it is now, where now like the church is okay. Maybe this was silent before, but we're saying the silent things out loud. Or was it they adapted something later on and said, "Hey, this makes sense for where we're trying to go. We didn't think about this before, but yeah, let's move with this." And then everything gets interpreted through that grid.
You know, I don't know. I mean, that's a broad question. I think I'd have to say, like, kind of an all of the above is probably true, right? To what you're describing. The way I look at where when you look at like the Christian nationalism phenomenon that's happening right now in the US, there's a whole lot of it that comes from, well, there's a number of different sort of there's a number of different sort of animating impulses, and they come from very, very, very different streams, right? So like you've got like the whole C. Peter Wagner New Apostolic Reformation movement. This thing emerges in the late 70s, early 80s. These were the people that thought that the 1984 Olympics were going to change the world, because people were going to come to Los Angeles and they were all going to hear the gospel and get radically saved and then go out to the four corners of the earth. And then Jesus was going to come back in 1988, you know, once that work of proselytization was finished. That movement continues today. It is like the New Apostolic Reformation movement is a very pro-Trump movement. There were a lot of those people that were involved in like the build up to January 6, 2021, and kind of all that happened that day. Bunch of them were there. A bunch of them were on the Capitol grounds that day. So you've got that. Then you've got this like reformed vision of it, which comes out of, you know, some of it comes out of like the theonomy world inside the Presbyterian Church. That stuff emerges around the sort of early 90s, I think, is when that stuff first starts to kind of get rewritten, really has a major influence on somebody like Wilson. It finds a new kind of animating energy in the Young Restless Reform movement of the 2000s. And, you know, and then it's given shape to another entire stream there. Then you've got like the Southern Baptist version of this. Southern Baptists have always been very nationalistic, very patriotic. They've always blurred the lines a bit between God and country. In, you know, First Baptist's July 4th celebrations in the 1970s, you know, if you're offended by them today, you would have been offended by them back then. And that, you know, there's like an anti-communist thing that kind of animates some of that way, way, way back then. I mean, that's what I would say, like, that's where you look at Christine Dumais' book and some of the history that she tells, where I think she, you know, there's things I would nitpick about her book, but I mean, I think she's right in that stream. So, what changes though is I think there was this interesting moment in the early 20 teens where, you know, that when Wilson was more intimately connected with, you know, some of the Acts 29 people, some of the Desiring God folks, and all of that, there is this moment where, around the time Trayvon Martin was killed, the race questions came to the surface and came to the conscience in a way where I think a lot of like middle of the road evangelicals were like, Yeah, there's something icky about the fact that Doug Wilson wrote Black and Tan. We're not comfortable with that. Like, that's not going to work for us. We're not going to go there. And there was a little bit of kind of a recession of some of that energy around the, we're building the new Christendom and all of that that he talked about. That all changes with Trump, though. And I don't know that it so much changed with Trump 2016, though certainly there was a lot of energy there
For sure.
that's where I think the new apostolic
There were
reformation
still
started.
more like people were grating against it. Like, hey, I'm not sure we should sign on to this fully completely.
Yeah,
I
I
don't know where this
mean,
is going.
MacArthur was never Trump in 2016. Mueller was never Trump in 2016. Like, a lot of those people were.
So it was Wilson. Wilson was never Trump.
And then by 2020, because he delivered on the Supreme Court, everybody had started to change their tune. And the captivity to it, I think, changed things. The other thing that I think happened was there was something about Trump that gave us a kind of shamelessness, where, some of the more nativistic, stuff, people felt a lot more permission to indulge in. And that's where, like, the stuff that really disturbs me right now in terms of like what came out this year, the white boy summer stuff and the the emerging, like, the hostility to these guys that are ranting on podcasts about the problems with the post-war consensus, and they're
Yeah,
all in
like I
love
don't
with
even
Pat
know what that is.
Buchanan.
That's
Well, they're
problem.
all parroting Pat Buchanan, and
Yeah, yeah.
like there's a reason Pat Buchanan was essentially ostracized from the party and why William F. Buckley kicked him out of National Review. He was an anti-Semite and he was a racist. And they're embracing it, and they're embracing it in this really shameless way. And I think Trump created the permission structure for that.
Yeah, and that's some of the same stuff we've been tracing. I mean, our trace has been much more related to COVID and the response in a lot of churches to COVID, whether that be we will comply with the government and COVID regulations, and then Wilson came out pretty strong against it with, along with a lot of other evangelical leaders. And then that's when he really started blending with them and saying, "Hey, I think we're fighting the same fight. Let's join this together," which goes back then to the stuff in your book, these ideological rallying points, then start bringing everybody else around with them. Like you said, the rank and file church members, even so, for the members of these churches, do you in you're writing the book, and even as yourself as a member of the church and talking to members of churches and your conversation with Mars Hill Church members or former members, of which I was formerly one way back in the day.
Wow.
And this is also like goes into my story a little bit, where I was at Mars Hill Huntington Beach, and I bought in hook, line, and sinker with stuff that Driscoll was saying, because I wanted a strong man. I wanted somebody who would buck against evangelical train to say, like, hey, we're gonna go in a different direction, and I'm gonna lead you there. And I'm gonna
Right.
lead you there well. And so we just like whatever he's gonna do, we'll follow. And it ended up us being less so ideologically aligned, more so like he like someone's gotta do it. So he's the
Yeah.
one, and we'll re-narrativize everything. So for yourself and for myself, for former members or regular members of these churches, do they see some of this stuff? Like, how do they interpret? So maybe the best way to ask, leadership in these churches, not versus, but compared to members of these churches, where these ideological shifts come in, how does that get strained through those two different lanes? Because I'm assuming members aren't thinking these to the degree that leaders are in churches. So how does that relationship? So to boil down my really long question, how does that relationship work between those who are leading the church, who seem to be leading the charge, and then the members who are following and just assuming like my pastor's writing everything, questioning whatever. So how does that relationship work between those who follow this or trend this, and those who are kind of along for the ride?
Yeah, so I think the key thing to come back to then is this idea. Let me offer a little definition in terms of what I get into in the book,
Do.
and we can pick it apart from there. So the big thing that I talk about in the book is this idea that evangelicals have not been immune to this phenomenon that's existed since the dawn of modernity, really, of ideology. And by ideology, I mean something very specific. I think it was Miroslav Volf who defined ideology as like the little idea that explains everything. Maybe that was Solzhenitsyn who put it that way. Ideology is this little idea that can explain everything. And so if you look at Nazism, Hitler's whole thing was the Germans are the superior race, they're the Aryan race, but what's holding us back? What's holding us back is the Jews. They've been living among us, they're undermining us, they're subverting us. If we can solve the Jewish problem, then we can liberate the Aryan race to be the superior race, and world domination, it's in our grip. Stalin basically does the same thing, but Stalin does it and he says the problem is, these middle managers, these capitalist middle managers who are keeping down the proletariat. He also happened to think that, Jews were the capitalist proletariats, and so his anti-Semitism was a whole problem as well on its own. And you have lots of different examples of this. Ideology is this thing where you go, there's one little problem, and if we solve it, utopia is on the other side of it. And you see it again and again and again in modern history. In the church, we have a similar version of this. And Driscoll makes for a great example of it because Driscoll's thing, he would often say, 99% of the world's problems are the fault of young men. And if you can reach young men with the gospel and reorient their way of thinking and seeing the world, then you can kind of achieve anything. You can
That's
reach the city,
exactly how he
change the
got
world.
me. I was a biology student. I wanted strength. I wanted somebody to tell me what to do. And then he started doing it. And I was like, all right, this works.
And so the power of ideology, though, is that it can explain everything. It becomes this lens through which you see everything. And so if you don't like Driscoll, well, the problem is you must be effeminate, or you must be a feminist, or you must not be committed to the Bible. Like there's always this, so it creates this iron logic where every single thing bends to
There's a
it.
reason why people aren't going to your church. Your church is dying. It's because you're not going after the men.
Right. And so if you're a casual member of the church, and the ideology appeals to you, you're probably not going to think that deeply about it. And if you ask a question, a leader is going to be able to give you this answer, like, hey, I heard there was a conflict with such and such pastor. Yeah, well, I mean, this is stuff that you would hear. Like, hey, I heard there was a conflict with such and such pastor and he moved on. What happened there? Well, his wife was really domineering. He wasn't much of a leader. We need churches. In this church, we need men who are real leaders, because real leaders are going to be able to, navigate those kinds of tensions well. So there's you can always go back to the ideology. The problem is somebody isn't living up to it fully. And they're not man enough, they're not tough enough, they're not domineering enough. And it accounts for almost everything. And I think what And again, I get into this in more detail in the book, but like there was a similar dynamic at Willow Creek, but it was the idea of leadership. Like, what does leadership look like? Why, how can leadership change the church? How can leadership change everything? And there were other there are lots of other versions of it that have appeared other places. So what happens, I think, is for the rank and file in the church, if they're captured by the story that the ideology tells, there's always going to be an explanation to any of their questions. Leaders are more culpable because leaders end up having to tell those stories. Leaders end up having to manufacture that logic that kind of chews people up and spits them out.
I don't know if this is covered in your book, but I'm curious how is some of this stuff disseminated? Like how does it get into the church? Because the church is or should be a bastion for the gospel, a bastion for preaching, set apart from the world, a kingdom not of this world. How does this first like how does it even creep into the church? Why does it seem like the church is so and not I'm painting with a very broad brush, but
Sure.
why does it seem the church like complies that why what is so tantalizing about some of these narratives, some of these story structures for the church itself when we have a narrative,
Yeah.
have a story structure?
you know, I think it's more caught than taught, right? But it is, I mean, that's where the role of the leader is, and where the culpability of the leader is so important, is because the leader is making a deliberate decision to say, I'm going to tell this story no matter what. Like, whatever the situation is, I'm going to come back to the ideology. I'm going to come back to the little idea that explains everything and make sure that it's consistently explaining everything. And so there is a willful choice happening at the heart of these organizations that, hey, in order to build a movement, this thing's got to be airtight. We can't show any cracks. We can't show any weakness. We can't show any flaws, because we can't let any doubt seep into the minds of our members that we know exactly what we're doing. So that's why it's unavoidable for members, is because it becomes the milieu that you're swimming in. You just hear the story over and over and over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. What's for churches going through this, or that which you write about, and again, building off of Arendt's work as well, like what's in it for those who are part of it? Like what's the goal? Is it a utopia? Is it domination? Mm-hmm. Is it a superior race? Is it I want to know that I'm better than you? Like what's in it for the churches? What is so tantalizing for them that they're like, hey, this is, we didn't believe this before, but now whatever it is, anti-Semitism or power hunger or Christian national, like whatever it is, what's in it for the church? What's in it for those within the church themselves?
Yeah. So there's a lot of debate about this, right? Like what's in it for the leaders of an abusive movement or a cult or a dysfunctional church. And my personal take on this, and I'm not sure I've got like data to cite to back me up on it or anything, but like my personal take on it is that I think these things only work if the leaders are true believers. They've got to really believe that what they're fighting for and pushing for is true and makes sense, and that it can achieve what they hope to achieve on the back end of it. I'm skeptical of the notion that like pastors get into this business, even at any level, the pastors get into this business on the basis of grift and greed and opportunism. Like certainly that's the case in some cases. Like there are those people that are out there, but I think the vast majority of them, they really believe it. And I think, you know, if you look for instance at Chuck DeGroat's book on narcissism in mm-hmm. the church, you know, one of the things that Chuck talks about is that these pastors tend to really believe the things they're saying. And it's not that it's true, it's that their own personal sort of distortions and woundedness sort of orient the world in such a way that they really do believe what they're telling you. Even if they're lying through their teeth at you, there's a distortion that takes place where they really believe what they're saying. And I think that's probably more true than not.
So they're not just using this for some end that they don't believe in. That's either they're too intertwined in this, or they believe it to such a degree that this is actually what they want. This is actually what they're pushing for.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Driscoll's story is very complicated, and there's elements of it that I don't want to speak to because they're not my story. There's elements that he should speak to. But I think when you understand where Driscoll came from and what his wounds are, there are certain elements about sort of his rage at a certain kind of father, certain kind of absentee dad, a certain kind of, and a certain kind of woman that really sort of shape and inform why he did what he did. He really believed if we get these things right, you know, we can make the world a better and safer and healthier and flourishing place for the gospel. And there's a lot of reasons why I believe that. Like among them, like mm-hmm. one of the things that was fascinating about Driscoll is like Driscoll wasn't in it for the money. Driscoll made money later, you know, later in the life of the church. But by the time Driscoll was making money, he was making money in part, and this often happens in these churches, he was making money because the executive leadership teams around him were going, we can't afford to hire the kinds of people that can run an organization this big because we don't pay you enough money. So we're gonna pay you a lot more money in order to make sure that we can pay the second in command guy enough to hire somebody who's worth, you know, who can handle the role. Like, that happens in mega churches all the time, all the time. They grow to a certain point. The pastor's like, I don't need to make more money than this. And then they realize, like, we can't afford to hire the talent because we're not competitive in the marketplace anymore. So we actually have to pay the pastor more.
I see.
It's Got pretty you. Fascinating. And that was totally true with Mark. Like, his windfalls, so to speak, around money with the church, they all came as the, you know, at the impulse of other people who stepped in later. Now, did that distort the way he saw things? Did that, you know, did he become more entitled as the church grew bigger and all that? Yeah, sure. I mean, that happens. Like, you can't help it. But I share that because I think it's important to share it because I think it speaks to this idea that, like, he really believed what he was preaching. He wasn't out for, you know, grift and manipulation. That didn't motivate him. He could have cared less about that on a certain level.
Yeah, I'm wondering too, and you, like, this is more what our series is for, is show these connections with Wilson, because Wilson doesn't have anything close to the size of Driscoll's church. You could argue he has something close to his influence, but in very different circles than Driscoll did. And Driscoll had I was at a church with probably 400 people at Huntington Beach, but I know across the board it was 15,000-16,000 or so. But Wilson's a slightly different study just because he has his publishing house, he has the educational ministry, he's got podcasts. I mean, he was a little bit after Wilson and some of the podcasting and audio stuff. But for Driscoll in particular, when I know for Paul, but was it, I'm thinking somebody who's thinking through the story, if they haven't heard the series, if they have heard the series, they see this all over the place. But with Paul's on isolated incident within Mars Hill lore, or this crossroads and what happens to the whole leadership when they buy into the same ideology. How does this play out as, like, for a mega church, how does this play out with Driscoll and those under him, for his members? What does this look? Because I think it's easy to see, like, one isolated incident. People could say, like, that's one thing, but it's not the whole. How did this play out? Because I know Driscoll and Mars Hill is a through line through this book. You use this as a test case. What does this look like as a on the institutional level of the church rather than just a single level? And then I'll get into Wilson and some of those parallels after that.
Yeah. I would say, I think the way to understand it institutionally is that, you're talking about something that is, I think it emerges somewhat slowly. So the way to think about it is that I think part of the reason this stuff emerges is because leaders find a story that works and they keep finding better and better ways to tell it. Right. So if we want to think about evangelical ideology, it's not like a pastor goes into their prayer closet and they come up with one of these sort of evil little ideas that can change the world. And then they map all these different ways that they're going to rely on it. Mm-hmm. It's that, you know, a whole variety of influences converge and they come up with a story that works. The story being, again, in Driscoll's case, the story being, you know, empowered young men are the things that are going to change the world. And then, you know, I think what happened with Paul is you found that the church had come to this place where they were exploding. They were gaining this national influence. Driscoll had published his first book. There was this incredible sense of, you know, God's doing something amazing here. We want to do everything we can to move this along as fast as possible.
Yep.
And so let's pull the restraints out of the way. It's not a question of, you know, no one's architecting spiritual abuse. That's just not how it works. What they're doing is they're saying the mission is so important. Hmm. We've got to get everything out of the way. And that starts with things like, let's create an empowered budget structure or whatever. Like, let's create an empowered polity. But then the more you sort of rely on this idea that the mission's so important that we need to remove all the obstacles, eventually you start having to get rid of obstacles that are people, right? Mm-hmm. Literal people who are going, hey, I've got to check in my spirit about this thing. Can mm-hmm. we talk about it some more? It's like, no, we can't talk about it. You've got to get out of the way or get out of the church.
Or get under the bus.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I mean, it was after kicking out Petri is when yeah. Driscoll's that famous phrase about, you know, there's a pile of dead bodies under the Mars Hill bus. Yeah. And if, you know, by God's grace, hopefully one day that's going to be a mountain. I mean, he said that and he believed it. And because what he saw was, I mean, he said this too, same speech. He said, I believe in blessed subtraction. Like there is a positive function in the life of a growing church that involves running people over it for the sake of the mission. Because once people become obstacles, we have to run them over. Mm-hmm. That is inherently unchristian. That is inherently an offense to the dignity of an individual human being in the world. Now, is there, like, I say that as somebody who believes in church discipline. I believe, mm-hmm. you know,
big time.
I believe there's yep. a time for that kind of stuff. That's not what they're talking about. This was not a church discipline case. This was a deliberation about polity that they chose to destroy someone's life over rather than actually just slow down and have the conversation.
Yeah, that brings up a few questions, I mean, that are both related to Marcel and the book too. When naysayers do come in, whether it be early or later in the development of this, how does that work with those who are in the leadership? How do they receive this? What do they think about this? Because at least in Wilson's case, naysayers on the front, I mean, they're shouted at. There's threats, whether they be legal, whether they be physical, whether they be we will have more stories later on and what happens. People do question. I mean, they are threatened physically, spiritually, everything, for much the same purpose and cause. But in this, what happens, like, what, I guess, practically speaking, to those who do come up against this and say, maybe at the beginning of this, when he's like, yeah, we need more young men, we need to have a church that caters to young men, and this is all we're going to do, when people do come up against this and say, hey, I don't know if this is what the church is about, this is not what I signed up for on the front end, how are they treated, I guess, the very beginning stages when they see, I don't like where this train is leading, not where it's like already full steam, but on the front end, like, hey, this is not a good trajectory. I don't like this at all.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of different answers to that question. I think it really depends. What I've seen is that kind of I've rarely seen occasions where the spiritual abuse happens all of a sudden. It seems to me that spiritual abuse evolves in a church as a leader becomes more and more empowered. Now there are exceptions to that. And I tell the story, actually, I tell the story in the book of the church that we helped to plant in the early 2000s, where, you know, I had this moment in the very early days of the church. I went to a like an informational meeting for this church plant where he had gathered, you know, potential core members and a few other, you know, potential donors and things like that. And he was casting vision for the church. Mm-hmm. And he literally laid out a vision for how they were going to have 1 million people in the church, you know, over the course of the influence of the thing, you know. Yep. And I thought I did what you did. I laughed because I thought he was joking. And then I realized, like, he's deadly serious. Like, isn't this a little crazy? Now, I was like 22 at the time. So who, you know, what did I know about like saying, hey, this guy's nuts. Let's not empower him to plant a church, you know? I assumed that everybody else around me knew what they were doing, and clearly there was something there that I didn't see. 6 months later, we had to shut the thing down because he had been a disaster and deeply spiritually abusive.
Yeah.
That wasn't about ideology distorting the gospel in the life of that community. That was about a narcissist who was narcissistic from the moment that he walked in the front door of the place. So all that to say, like, I think it's all case by case. But again, my hunch on this thing is it's like success is just a hell of a drug. And so as you start to, again, if you think of ideology as this story we're telling about how we're going to change the world, you start telling the story and you start finding success in it. You start gathering lonely, isolated people, and suddenly they're finding community and purpose and belonging for the first time in their life. And you get this sense of momentum. You get this sense of like, hey, we can actually make a difference here. You know, over time, there's kind of a cumulative effect to that empowers you to tell that story more fiercely, more rigidly.
Yeah.
You know, the logic becomes that iron logic, those iron jaws that sort of chew up your moral perspective and everything else along the way. That's a whole different thing. And then you start to kind of justify the grift in it as well. Power's a hell of a drug too. And I think the interesting thing with Wilson is, you know, what I see when I look at Wilson, it's like you said, like Wilson's not, he's not the pastor of a 15,000 member church. He's
No.
not planting in
He'll
five
never be a
states.
pastor. It's just not set up that way.
It's not set up that way. But what he has done is he's created this ecosystem where the more you buy in, the deeper it goes for you, and your entire life gets
Yeah, it's not just a
subsumed
church.
by
If you're looking for books, he's got books. If you're looking for a school, he's got a school. If you're looking for media, he's got media.
it. Yeah, it's entertainment, it's a lifestyle, it's a there's a lot
It's a
there, and
city
it's
too. It's Driscoll didn't run the city as far as I'm aware, but
right.
Wilson
Far
sort
from
of
it.
runs Moscow.
Yeah, so I mean I think that's an interesting that's just a very different dynamic, and I don't, again, like I haven't studied it like you have. I don't know it from the inside, but I think it is fascinating that the level at which my hunch is that for people who are in the church, there's almost like a there's probably almost like a caste system based on like how bought in are you
Very much
really?
so.
Like
Very much so.
how much have you dialed in your
There's
life
that,
and
but there's
family life?
also, I mean, in Wilson's case, there's much more blood too. It's if you're related, you're elite. And outside of that, there's kind of a slightly lower one where if you are bought in, then you're right next to them, but you're not quite elite.
Interesting.
You're not quite part of that, which I think does differ from Driscoll, even though I think it's different for Driscoll now in his new church in Scottsdale, because there's like his family runs that church, which is not the
Yeah.
case at Mars Hill.
No. No. Yeah, no, I mean Driscoll's model in Scottsdale is kind of the classic AOG Pentecostal family run church model. And I think he deliberately adopted that based on, you know, recommendations he was given when he started. So
So last question on the book, and then just a few questions that also relates to Rise and Fall, but the last half, and then we've gotten pretty sour and dour on all this stuff. And people were like, is there any hope for the church? Like how does she get out of this stuff? If it seems like there's this grip on the church that she can't get out of, and that she's so bought into, and all these leaders are, whatever their ideological system may be, that they're pushing this. Where does she go? How do we figure this out? If we are at this crossroads, how do we figure out which way is the right way to go? How do we loosen our grip on, like you said, this power as a drug, success as a drug? How do we loosen our grip from this? And I know you talk about Eugene Peterson. I've read a lot of him before. So what wisdom were we given, or how do we move from here?
Yeah, there's a number of things. So probably about a little more than half of the book is kind of focused on understanding where we are and how we got there. And then the rest of the book is focused on what are some of the keys for us to kind of break out of this pattern and this rhythm. And I offer a number of solutions. I do talk a bit about Peterson. There's an interesting Peterson connection to Mars Hill. It's very indirect, but it was kind of a poetic thing that I discovered as I was working on the thing. But then what I really focus on in the book is you know, two big ideas that I think I just keep coming back to. One is that the church, Christians have to be people who know how to think. And the way we learn how to think is we cultivate solitude, we cultivate silence, we cultivate a kind of intimacy with God that gives us just a deep sense of discernment and an ability to think and to judge. And those are all things Arendt talked a ton about. I mean, Arendt's whole thing was the reason totalitarianism happens and mass destruction happens is because people choose not to think anymore. They choose to stop thinking and just accept the slogans and cliches and stories that they're being bombarded with. And then the other one that I think is worth mentioning in this conversation, and I talk about some other things too. I mean, I talk a lot about culture making, and I could go into a lot of detail on that. But then, you know, I end the book talking about worship. And I just think you can't get away from this. What Christian worship is supposed to do is it's supposed to, I mean, John Whitfield put it perfectly, a professor at Calvin University. Whitfield says, the purpose of Christian worship is to prepare us for our encounter with death. Now, far too often, the function of Christian worship in North America right now is to get us excited about being part of whatever church we're a part of. Mm-hmm. It's to motivate us for quote unquote the mission. It's to get us excited about quote unquote the vision. You know, my own pastor, you know, I'm still a member of the church that I helped start, and I'm, you know, still friends with our pastors there, and I'm still, you know, I'm still involved in all kinds of ways. And my pastor one time said to me, you know, now that you're done with the Mars Hill project, like, is there anything when you come to church that like makes you nervous about what we do? And I was like, no, I mean, genuinely, like, I mean, our church has been through its issues. Don't get me wrong. I said, genuinely, no. Like, and then I sat for a second. I go, actually, when you say the word vision, it makes me want to run for the exit. I don't need my pastor to have a vision. Right? Like what I need is the gospel. Mm-hmm. And what I need is the story of the gospel as a rooting story that gives me a sense of purpose and belonging that's much bigger than the next capital campaign or the next, you know, Christmas service where we're supposed to invite our friends or Easter service or whatever. Not that I'm against any of that. I'm not against, you know, I'm not against big churches. Like I have two friends who are pastors of churches of like, I think one of them is a pastor of a church of 20 something thousand, and another one's a pastor of a church of like 30 plus thousand people. And I think these are godly men leading good communities. Like, I'm not against the idea of big church. What I'm against is the idea that church becomes the church itself becomes the mission rather than the story of God, the story of the gospel, this rooting story that like, that has a sense of awareness and humility of the fact that like, this thing started long before us. It's going to keep going long after us. And you know what? If you don't do your part, it's going to be fine. Like it's not about you. It's about what God is doing and what God has done and what God promises to do in the future. I mean, it's the part of the Mass that I actually really love, even though I'm, you know, profoundly reformed still and all of that. Like, like the moment in the Eucharist when the pastor or the priest or whoever says, Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. Yeah. Like past, present, future, man. Like we are a small part of something big and beautiful and mysterious. And when the mission gets narrowly defined to, hey, if we do this one thing and we do it right, we're going to change the world. It eclipses that gospel story, which is quiet and is never going to demand our attention in those ways. So that's a very long answer to your question, no, but that's That's what I think really matters in all of this.
That's a great answer too. And that's helpful. And it just a few questions that are not specifically related on the book, but just this movement in general. And you've profiled this at Mars Hill. We're doing our best to profile this with Wilson. Having written this book and now looking back on the work that you've done on Mars Hill, on the investigative journalism you've done on Mars Hill, on the stories. And I know I'm going to think the same thing myself, even a month from now, a year from now, 3 years from now. Looking back on what you saw, Marcel, do you think you saw the full picture? Was there anything that you like, man, I missed this and I wish I pushed this further? I didn't see the full extent of the damage that was happening. And now that I'm a few years past and have written this book, I see this a little bit clearer than I did that. What has changed? What has morphed since writing this, reflecting more on this, and after having done all the research you've done on Marcel specifically?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot that
I imagine,
see a little bit differently and all that, because I mean, just the time matters a ton. Now, I'll just to be clear, like, I can't point to anything in the podcast where I look at it and go, hey, we really got that wrong.
That's good.
There are a couple things that I point to. There's one episode in particular, and I'm not going to say which one. There's one episode in particular that I wish I could rework, because I think I could have said it better than we said it. I don't think we were wrong. I just don't know that we articulated things quite as well as we could have. What I do feel, though, is I do feel like having gone through the process of writing this book, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to shill for the book necessarily.
No, please do. This is show for the
by
book.
All means by the book, you know.
Yeah.
But the book really is driving at the underlying question of, like, why did this happen? How does this happen? How does it keep happening? Because it's and it's, I mean, look, it's a 60,000 word book. Like, that's a complicated question, and it involves a lot of history. I mean, I go back to Genesis 3. I spent a lot of time there. I spent a lot of time with the Book of Job. I spent a lot of time with the Reformation. I spent a lot of time with Galileo and kind of the scientific revolution and the way that changed the way we think about the world. Because what ideology fundamentally is it's a modern phenomenon. It's this idea that the world is comprehensible and that we can find a formula and a program to solve for anything, including changing the world for the sake of the gospel, which is nonsense when you say it out loud.
And it's entirely, but, like you said, modern phenomena. They weren't thinking these questions prior to the 16th century.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, the church, the best examples and the best traditions of the church have always understood themselves to be, you know, essentially like mere church. Like, we are part of something that's much bigger than us. And
we're part of the redemptive story. We're part of it. We don't drive it. We're part of it.
And we don't feel anxious about making it come to its ultimate conclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really a phenomenon of evangelicalism that I think is, like, dangerous and has fed a lot of dangers. So all that to say, like I've gotten, that's where the book tries to kind of get into those deeper questions and deeper answers beyond the story itself. And hopefully in such a way that it's so the book really tries to get into those deeper questions and deeper answers in a way that the podcast just wasn't designed to exactly do that. So hopefully that's helpful to people.
Gotcha. Even thinking prior to how did you even get into some of this stuff? It's were you connected to Driscoll in some way, shape, or form? I don't know if you talked about that in the series. I know you talked to a lot of people who were. How did Mike Cosper find himself as, like, I'm the Marcel guy now. I'm the guy who talks about all this stuff now.
Oh man. So we planted our church in 2000, and then in 2004, it was actually at the Southern Baptist Convention in 2004. Our church was planted by the SBC. We were a NAM church. Shout out to Ed Stetzer, who, you know, got us our funding and mentored us. And I love Ed. Ed and I are good friends to this day. In 2004, we went to the Southern Baptist Convention as, like, part of the dog and pony show for the North American Mission Board. And we met Darren Patrick. Darren was on the board of Acts 29 at the time. And Darren, you know, Darren later became one of my best friends. And I talk about Darren in another book that I've written where I kind of tell that story a little bit. I mean, Darren and I used to always tell Darren, like, I'm glad he was my friend. I'm also glad I don't work for him, because Darren was a complicated guy as well, you know, and had his issues. But he recruited us into Acts 29, and we were part of Acts 29 from about 04 to 2010. We left around the time of the elephant room, if you remember all that craziness. And we started our own church planting network right after that. But during that time, you know, because the church that I was a part of, and because the ministry that I led had a really influential music ministry inside Acts 29, that led to leading worship at a bunch of conferences and doing different stuff and getting to know a lot of the Acts 29 guys through that. So there's a number of folks that are in the podcast. You know, the voice that's the bookend for the whole series is, aside from mine, is Tim Smith, who
I
was
know
the
who he
lead
is.
music guy for many years. And Tim and I were good friends and remain good friends to this day. And so yeah, so I had a because of Tim, like I kind of had a front row seat to all of that stuff. And actually, I have a funny Driscoll story. The first time I met Driscoll was in 2008. I was asked to help lead worship at the Acts 29 Pastors and Wives Retreat in Vail, Colorado. And so this is like, you know, a couple hundred pastors from around the country and their wives showing up for, you know, at a ski resort in the middle of summer. And my wife and I did not have a good first day at this retreat, because people would meet us and they would be like, "So where are you, like, where are you involved in ministry?" And we would say, "Oh, I'm the worship pastor at Sojourn in Louisville." And it was like, as soon as they realized I wasn't a lead pastor, they were done with the conversation. They were totally not interested in anything we had to say. It was really unfortunate. It was really kind of like weird and cliquish and cruel and gross. And so by the end of the day, like, you know, my wife had noticed it, I had felt it. We were both just like, "Ugh, this sucks." And but we had our baby with us. Our daughter was 10 months old at the time, and she was with us. And so we go to this like reception. Well, Driscoll hadn't shown up yet. Driscoll was coming to the reception. And it was just this funny moment. It was this like imperial moment when Driscoll walks in the room, kind of like, you know, everybody, like, as soon as he walks in the room, you know, he's everybody's hero. Everything kind of stops. And
Which is so
he
funny because
like,
he's so small. He's so
right.
short. It's
He's a short guy.
the weirdest presence.
But he spent like, it's like 2 minutes, no more than that. He's glad handing a few people by the door and saying hello. And then he spots my wife with our baby. And like, to her credit, Dorothy was the most beautiful baby you have ever seen. Like, she was like Gerber baby beautiful. We had people telling us, like, "She needs to be a baby model. You will make so much money," which we never did. So he spots Dorothy, and Driscoll loves kids. He loves babies, loves kids. And he makes a beeline for my wife. And he walks up to her and he goes, "That's the most beautiful baby that I've ever seen. And I'm the father of five children," or whatever it was he was, you know, whatever they were at the time, you know. And we were like, "Yes, indeed, she is the most beautiful baby you have ever seen." And here's what's really truly crazy is Dorothy hated strangers. She absolutely hated strangers. And he goes, "Can I hold her?" And Sarah was like, "If she'll go to you," but she never goes to anybody, and she doesn't even get the sentence out, Dorothy jumps in his arms. And he spends the next 45, he goes, "If you're okay with it, I'll just carry her around with me. I love babies. Tell me if I'll feed her crackers or whatever, like whatever she's allowed to eat, you let me know. If you get uncomfortable, I'll co just come get her. You can have her. But I love babies. I will be so much happier at this thing if I get to carry her around." And for like 45 minutes, he carried her around while he's like making the rounds. He's feeding her cheese and crackers and all this. And she's just loving him, absolutely loving him. And so that was my first encounter with Driscoll, was, and it was like, it was the first moment at this thing where we had just totally felt out, you know, like outsiders and unwelcome.
He brought you
We
guys
felt
in.
so welcome. And he kept coming over and saying hi and telling Sarah what a great mom she was, and talking about how beautiful Dorothy was, and Grace was so sweet to us and all that. And so we ended up having a number of other encounters over the years. I led worship at conferences that he spoke at and all that. But that was like that's my first. I love telling that story because it's like, because I'm deeply committed to the idea that people are not just one thing and they're very complicated. And so as much criticism as I have of Mark, I also understand the people who love Mark and the people who were blessed by him. I was blessed by him. I was blessed by him very directly that night. I was blessed by his preaching. There are aspects of his sermons that I still look back on and I'm thankful for. The first time I ever heard him actually teach was in 2000 and 2001. It was right after 9/11. He gave this incredible talk at a conference that has stuck with me forever. So I think people are complicated, but I think there's something about the cultural ethos that we get sucked into and that leaders get sucked into that's deeply damaging. And in particular, I just think a lot about I just think a lot about how the church itself has the tools and the resources to resist this stuff. We just have to understand how to access those.
Yeah. Last question. This is just pure curiosity. Did you expect Rise and Fall of Mars Hill to be the cultural phenomena it was in 2020? I had to assume there's a little bit because it had Christianity Today behind it, but did you expect like everybody? Because that's we're not quite as popular as Rise and Fall, but we're getting there. And we did not expect our response. We knew people were going to be interested. Did you expect what happened after Rise and Fall?
No, not at all. I mean, what we really expected was I expected pastors and church leaders to find it helpful to kind of revisit the history and understand why it happened. I did not expect it. I mean, I think at this point we're at close to 30 million downloads on the series. Like, we did not expect that. We expected it to be, maybe 100,000 downloads per episode, and most of that to be from pastors and church leaders.
Sure.
But I think there was just kind of something about the zeitgeist that we tapped into. And look, I mean, Driscoll is compelling. You can't
Yes.
help but grin when you hear him talk, even when he's saying things that make you cringe. He's just a compelling character. And so that's the benefit of telling that kind of story is you just find yourself going, man, like this guy's out there, but I can't look away. And so I think, we didn't anticipate that. We didn't think about that going into it. So yeah, no, it was very much a surprise.
Gotcha. So now, last wrapping up question, maybe for both the podcast, because the podcast and like you said, the book dives deeper than the podcast does and explains some things. Not that we're left unexplained, but explain some things that the podcast just wasn't looking at as deep. What's your hope for this book? And then maybe to jumping off of the podcast, what was your hope for the podcast? And then now what's your further hope for the book itself?
My hope for, I mean, my hope for the podcast was that, in retelling this story and in showing some of the moments of grace that cut through it, and in just being a Christian voice that says, like, hey, that's not okay, to some of the things that were problematic, that it would help people see Jesus as more beautiful and believable than before. And that it would maybe help like reframe the conversation around the church, like help the church aspire to something better and more beautiful than that. I think the same thing is true with the book. Like I just am, I just really want the church to care about the things that are worth caring about, are worth, I want the church to be oriented around things that can really make a difference in the world. And I think way too often we're just excited about the wrong things, like we're compelled by the wrong things. And it's done a lot of damage to be oriented that way. So that's my hope and prayer.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.